How do you survive on Amazon?
Amazon doesn't give a fuck. They get the conversion anyway. It doesn't matter if it's you or them or over there. They don't give a fuck. They're still making money. They don't care about you. It's not designed for you. Understand there's something outside the Amazon community bubble that we don't know about. Embrace the unknown, look into it, and then make your own agency of decision. You're your own person. Be critical. Have a curiosity. That's what got you into the game. Don't lose sight of these things. Once you let go of other people's opinions, testing becomes a lot easier. So I think survival on Amazon now is...
Welcome to Surviving Amazon, the podcast that exposes the brutal truth behind selling on Amazon and only the strongest survive. We bring you insider stories and strategies from experts and sellers who've been through all the ups, the downs, the moments that made them question if it was even worth it. I'm Johnny Bradley, and today we're joined by Danny McMillan. He has battled through the craziness of selling on Amazon and actually helped thousands of sellers do exactly the same. Host of Seller Sessions podcast, Seller Sessions Live, co-founder of Databrill. He has what I would call the no BS approach to selling on Amazon, looking at the data, the science to seek the source of truth and making those topics understandable for sellers. He's recently been working on an article that breaks down some of the huge myths with things like the honeymoon period, cold start system, and a bunch more that I'm really looking forward to talking about today. He's lived it, he's survived it, and he's here to share exactly how he does it. So first question, Danny, is how do you survive on Amazon?
That's a good question. And it starts with products. Let's go back. I've been in the game since 2015 when I started as a seller, and I was selling till 2020, and I have an agency, and I've seen over 1,000 accounts through when we've done under the hoods, like potential clients, and obviously we've got existing clients. One of the most common themes I've seen is it comes down to product, not propping up the product with ranking. So if you see the article, it's in depth. Me and Marna spent 200 hours on it. It's a labor of love. But at the end of the day, none of that works. If you don't have a good product or you don't understand what's wrong with the product, you need to get your custom objections. And that's not very sexy to do, but it's very necessary. So I think survival on Amazon now is more about data, less about hacks. I mean, we're fellow Brit, Fraser. It did a podcasting a little while ago. It does 50 million a year. And he'd be the first to admit that he gets the basics right. He doesn't know a lot about A9 ranking and stuff like that, but he does 50 million a year because he's good at product. And I think there's two types generally. I come in from a marketing angle. I think you come in as marketing or you come in as product generally, and then you have to learn the other end of the spectrum. But I would argue it doesn't matter what I know about ranking and how I help my clients and stuff. If the product's not right and it's not a fit, it doesn't matter. There is no magical PPC campaigns and stuff like that. And it's hard to explain that to people. And this is like, you've seen it on the show, the tool that we've built, which is the pairwise system, which allows us to analyze the top 10 organic results on a certain keyword. So let's say someone comes to you and go, I want to launch this product on this keyword. Well, it's in isolation. You don't know how much you're going to spend and everything else because you haven't got a crystal ball. And instead of having necessity to having that conversation, which was a regular conversation over and over, and no one's got data, it's just a gut feeling, I want to work with this, right? And then it's, can you bring my ACoS down, right, as an example. The reason I built it was because then we could plot and insert their product and take one of them out and then use it as a pairwise system. And then once it brings out the favorability score, and these are real feedback because there's people that get paid to complete the task, right, to compare the products. And then when they see that, they go, oh shit, yeah, I've come in at number 10, which means it's the worst ranking that you're going to get, so you've got a low favorability score. And because you're able to visually see it, they'll go, well, I'll optimize my listing, we do this, do that. So I built a tool for that. And the point of saying this, I think it's coming down to science now, it's coming down to testing. If you've got it down to a fine art, like a lot of people do, they're very good at product research, right? Very good. So what they do is they go and look at everyone else's products, and they look at reviews, which are not custom objections, they're post-purchase feedback. Big difference. So they've already bought it, and then they either love it or they complained about it. So then what they do is extrapolate this, and it's very clever, extrapolate all this information, and then with their mousetrap, they Frankenstein a new one and go, I know what to do now because I've looked at everyone else's problems and I'm fixing them with my product. But then they don't ask the question, what are your objections to buying this product? And then what they do is they launch the product convinced because they've done all the research diligently, but they haven't asked the question on their own product. And then they get 3 months in, high spend. You've seen this cycle over and over and over and over again. And being entrepreneurs, what do? They ignore what everyone else says. They've got a vision and they grind out results because that's why they're in the 3% in terms of 3%, say, of the population are entrepreneurs and employing people, whether that's small business to larger entrepreneurs. But if you realize that your time and attention are your most important assets and where you put them, you realize is that if you do customer objections and you're able to fix the problems, you're going to have a better chance. It doesn't matter what you know about algorithms to a certain degree, because you can be a little bit sloppy on the marketing end if you've got a superior product. But what we've got to be careful of is having an inferior product that hasn't had its customer objections and then try and prop it up with rankings and hacks. And then you're in this dopamine cycle. Do you understand what I'm coming from? So I think really now it's more about testing and getting the basics and the boring stuff right.
So if we look back, you know, 2015, 2017, these things weren't necessarily as important, right? Because you could put something on Amazon, do some discounts and like, bang, you're like, wow, you're on the first page. Yeah. It's completely different. Now it's like, what I'm getting from this is you have to know your customer. You need to know why they're buying, who's buying, who they're buying it for, what's their demographic.
And they do. People build a customer avatar, but they skip the customer objections part. So they're doing all this SWOT analysis, all this stuff, and it's right, but they're not asking the question to 100 people, what's the, you know, what are your objections to buying this product?
Why wouldn't you buy it? And then I've got a really interesting, you know, test that I did with that, where we were trying to figure out how to get a product to, it's actually pre-launch, right? What we're going to do to market this product. And the question that kept coming up is that, oh, I just want to make sure it works, right? It was one of these real products where they didn't believe that it would really work. I was like, how the hell can we do that? And what it ended up being was, it was a before and after photo that everyone's done. Right? Everyone's done these before and afters. But all we did was add on the text, does it work? Yes. And that was it. That then answered that question for that customer. And it allowed that conversion rate on launch was 30%. We took that, added it to another ASIN. It had a nice uplift in their conversion rate. Did it with another product, did absolutely nothing, not anything whatsoever, because it wasn't right for that customer.
That's the thing we're testing. Yeah, and that's the thing we're testing. You know, proven strategies are great, but you test the strategy rather than assume that you're going to get the same conversion rate on a different product in a different market at a different price point. Yeah, and if you're truly into testing, you realize a lot of them don't get the results you want. So let's say you're all sitting around the table, you all know your product, and I think it were, if you have a look at a guy, he's the godfather of conversion optimization, is a guy called Peep Larger. He runs Conversion Excel, and I discovered him in 2008. And he calls it HIPPO, highest person's opinion or something, it's abbreviated. And then what they'd do, they'd sit down, the CEO would have his bit, and everyone else is talking and pontificating over, you know, what customers want and everything else. And he's like, why don't we just test? And it was alien to them. So then that was always the battle. And of course, if you say it's going to go this way, it completely goes the other. And it depends on the person, right? Because everyone's individuals. If they thought their thing didn't come out on top, they'd ask for a retest because they need to be right. Do you understand? Once you let go of that, once you let go of other people's opinions and stuff, testing becomes a lot easier. And I think when you get attached to something, and someone attacks your product like they do in reviews. Reviews are more impactful because it's public and it affects your review score. But when you do get feedback, you could get really bad feedback, right? I've had loads of it. And then you've got to go, that's what I asked for. What can I learn from this? Do you understand? Everything needs to be tested, but there's not enough hours in the day. So you've got to work out what are you going to do? What's the most important things? Right? And have a system in place, because your ideas will be different to the next person.
I always say
priorities.
And this is what I say to clients, to everybody, is I don't know, you don't know, that person doesn't know, that person doesn't know. No one knows. We can only use the data and the law of large numbers to make informed decisions. It may not even be true or false. It may be that we ask 100 people and all the 100 people end up giving you the answer that, which is wrong, right? Because we needed to ask 10,000 people. Mm. And I think once you really understand that within any business, not specifically selling on Amazon, any business, particularly when we talk about conversion rate or any sort of optimization, it's we don't know until we've done the test. And then even then we don't know. We just have a better idea than when we did, you know, a week ago. I think you raised a really good point with the, you know, Amazon is much more now becoming about the science and the technology and more of a numbers game. And this is where I guess you put a lot of work into trying to really understand what's going on behind that. You did a podcast the other week and it was about the honeymoon period, right? So this is something that we think is true or it's been propagated in through everyone, through everywhere, that this there's this magic sauce that you get when you launch your product on Amazon. That I've talked about it. I've been a victim.
We all have. We've all done it. And a very close friend of mine. Yeah, a close friend of mine who came up with a term in 2015 is Anthony Lee. And I even got him back on to the show because like me, he's into the science literature as well. He's doing a lot more stuff around AI now. But he truly didn't really get his flowers for what he did. Because back in 2015, they were the first launch agency, right? And so if you imagine you've got all of this data and you're building all these suite of tools, then you've got a lot more data than other people to see. And that's why it's important. When we did the article, if you read the first part of the article, there's a number of papers. So I don't go back all the way because there's not enough science around it. But I start with 2016. Doria Sononica from the A9 team does a presentation, ML conference. And she talks about the honeymoon period in the terms of the cold start. So a cold start is a general term for anything. A cold start could be you start a new PPC campaign, you've got no historic data. So you're starting from a cold start. So this whole honeymoon period, cold start thing is a business issue. And that issue is we've got thousands of products we need to give visibility to, okay? But how do we do it? There's only 24 hours in the day. There's multiple categories. So we have to turn up the winners and the hits. The losers and the winners, right? Because what's most important is to get the right product in front of customers. Now, in that video, she explained something called the hunger score that goes into the category. The deeper it goes, the more hungry it gets, and then it starts to bring up products. Then she talked about manual overrides, like she used Harry Potter as an example. There was a new book come out, and it weren't seen in the search results, so the business team were breathing down their neck, and they had to do manual adjustments because the tools they had back then, right? Bearing in mind, I'm aligning this with the honeymoon period and Anthony, right? So there's menu overrides, which, you know, I've said before, things like this, I've got more chance of marrying Alicia Keys than you getting a menu override. So you can't really call it a honeymoon period. That's not to deny visibility. There's your foundation, right? So we're going back to 2015. Let's pump forward now. Almost everything's in real time, right? Mm-hmm. There's advancements. So we charted the advancements in between. And there's the cold guess paper, there's the empirical bays. And so what's happened over that period of time? It wasn't until the patent where they had a fully functioning, what's called a Bayesian update, right? So we can go into all the geek of it, but if you imagine what happened back then is it took longer for Amazon to decide on a product in layman's terms. And so you did have a honeymoon period, but over the years it's got smaller and smaller because the business decision that they've made is to churn out hits, okay? And technology progresses. So we use the term...
I would say, just to stop you on that, but just so we understand that, you're saying over the time period, Amazon has got better at understanding what your product is so it can give it the visibility that it should be getting.
So let me give you an example in layman's term and then the technical. So in layman's term, the way it breaks down is three stages. There's best guess, real data, new estimate. That's a Bayesian update in this sense. What that actually means is you launch a product. Amazon then has to apply what's called a prior or initial prior. What they do is they look at existing similar products with similar attributes, then make a calculation until real data comes in. So you launch a product and then you start running PPC. What happens? Real data comes in. Then what happens is this is the initial prior, not just the prior, so not to confuse things. So you launch a product, Amazon have to make a calculation. They have to do it based on similar product attributes, hence why I keep going on about attributes all the time. And most optional attributes, 90%, are not filled in on the back end. You're missing out because you're focused on keywords, got to tie it all in. So you've got the initial best guess, which is the prior taken from similar products with similar attributes. And then you get what's called the real data. So once you've got the initial and then you've got the real data, they then have to make a calculation. Now that calculation, if that's done for the first time on the product, it does this what's called a Bayesian update, which then creates what's called a posterior, and a posterior refines over time. So in the papers, there was a 2022 paper that shows there's a frequency clock of the Bayesian update, and that can be anywhere between 2 and 24 hours. So if you want to go on honeymoon for 24 hours, be my guest. So we joke about it, TikTok, you're on the clock. From the moment you come out the blocks, let's say you got 24 hours, and it depends on if it's new catalog, we don't have the weighted aspect to this. So for instance, when it becomes, the clock can become longer because you've got the initial prior, and then you've got the posterior updating over time. We'll get into deleting ASINs and a bit later, and we can apply that methodology. But the point I'm trying to say is, over this period of time, since Anthony used that word, we've had 8-9 years of technology, mm-hmm. and all it's done is got faster. So your window's got smaller. Mm-hmm. So what you see, I'm not going to gaslight you and tell you your observation's wrong, far from it. But what I'm saying is, there is a patent that got updated. As the last update was, there's two parts to it, and we cross-reference it. It was 23rd of November 2023. And it was important when we did the article was to weave in BERT, Cosmo and everything else, because all of these are stacked. So a lot of people look at, you know, Cosmo's the latest thing. Well, we just didn't get rid of 30 years, 20 years or whatever of search. You've got carefully crafted algorithms and they're built on top. It's the same with a lot of stuff we talk about listings. So when someone's talking about filling your listing with keywords that index, basically, in layman's term, that's lexical matching. That's the foundation of the web, and it has been since the very beginning. Where the nuances come in is you've got semantic, which is giving you variants on that, and then you've got bidirectional, which is BERT, conversational, without going into graphic detail. So if you imagine that you've got beard oil, and so beard oil's here, but there's a refinement. What else are the alternatives to beard oil? You know, it could be beard moisturizer, and then it could be a question, then it could be this. So these are all stacked on top of each other. It's not a zero-sum game. So when everyone's talking about it's all about semantic matching now, well, it's not just all about that. So basically, semantic fills the gaps between lexical, and then there's a semantic gap with another paper. It's called text type, which I haven't wrote up yet, because I applied a lot of Cosmo to the semantic gap. So what I'm trying to say is, the idea of it is refinements over time, so they get better results for the customer. So what we do is we look at honeymoon period, and we look at keywords, and then we look at our ranking, and ranking updates what every 1 to 2 hours. So if ranking's updating 1 to 2 hours, why would you get 7, 14 days, 21 days, 30 days honeymoon period on the product, when the business decision is we've got to churn these products, thousands of those a day, and there's only 24 hours in the day, and there's only 60 minutes in an hour, and there's only 60 seconds in... Do you know what I'm saying? So when you look at it like that...
I was going to say, so if looking at this from a couple of... There's lots of things to dissect on that. Absolutely. In reverse order, I guess.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, it may feel like for a seller, oh, this is 7 days or 2 weeks or
absolutely.
Whatever it comes
out. They're your observations.
It feels like this... Observation, but in reality, things are happening a lot faster. So that if you're not, and I think maybe a way to sum this up is there's no one silver bullet. You can't just like optimize for Cosmo, or you can't just have keywords or just have good images. It's lots of different things are giving Amazon what they need in all of these different systems to do its job in what it's...
So let me ask you a quick question, right? You see a well-optimized listing, okay? Mm-hmm. And then you look at their back end, and then you... And attributes are different on a product level with inside of the category, so the fields are different. In the optional areas to complete, how often do you see them filled other than keywords? Most of it...
I would say very, very rarely you would find everything completed.
So if this is true, and a patent they decided to update, and they used the initial best guess as an initial prior, looking at similar performing products and their attributes. Now, attributes is a wide scope, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you think about Rufus, which is an AI assistant that's plugged in, very clever though, and it's always learning all the time, it's using more than just keywords at index. And if you look at semantic in terms of matching and BERT, they don't require index. They scan the whole listing anyway. And we don't get access to information of every organic search, right? Mm-hmm. So you come up for beard oil, but you might come up for beard conditioner, or you might come up for X, Y, and Z variants depending on the match type. But you don't see it. So we're not optimizing for what we don't see. And I understand that. But then if we were to flip it around a bit, if you look at the... when Amazon gives you suggestions to your listing, the first thing they do is they gut the title and the bullets and you go, it's shit, right? Mm-hmm. What can we learn from that? What it's saying is we don't need all this other stuff in here.
Yeah.
We've got it unlocked. Don't worry about it. And oh, by the way, soon we're going to be dynamically changing your titles as well. Mm. Because what happens, they're playing 3D chess and a lot of us are out here playing checkers trying to catch up. Do you understand?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we're thinking, we've got to have 80 characters in our title, whatever. And they're like, who gives a shit? Yeah. Like, this is, we don't need that. You can have a 10-word title.
We need it. So you've got to understand is we need it. Whether you're an agency working for sellers or the sellers themselves, we need the conversion rate. Amazon doesn't give a fuck. They get the conversion anyway. It doesn't matter if it's you or them or over there. They don't give a fuck. They're still making money. They don't care about you. It's not designed for you. Do you understand? It's designed for the customer to get and enrich the experience for them and Amazon to make more money than they're already making and dominant and be a dominant force, right? So we have to move away from our own personalized solipsism and think about the customer and understand is that, you know, a low-level engineer on the Amazon science team on 150 grand a year probably knows more than all of us in our little than in his little finger. Do you understand? We're at this level, and I don't want disrespect, and I called myself a student of the game, not an expert, because it's just too much to understand. Do you understand? And so I think it's important. It's not about who's right, but it's important to get as close to the truth as possible. And along the way, people will come up with their opinions, their strategies and everything else, and then once you fold them all in together, you work with what works and then discard the rest. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. Because we can look at the patents, we can look at the reports, we can look at the science, we could do all of that sort of stuff. We also don't know that that's everything. We don't know what they're working
on. Far from everything.
We don't know what they're testing.
But nor is Cosmo, and nor is Rufus. It's just sexy to sell. It's easy. Yes. It's digestible. But let's not dismiss everything else. Right? Mm-hmm. If you think with all the papers, it really started to blow up with people looking at the papers as soon as Cosmo come out. Why? It's one of the only papers that's got loads of pretty pictures in. It's easy to digest. And I respect that because I'd rather you break down the paper and then test against it than just make something up with a single screen grab and then call that science and then call it proven when it's only been proven once. Science is meant to be repeatable. The problem that we face is if you look at it as a quadrant, you've got over here, you've got the science. Over here, you've got the observations with the variables, small data set. Down here, you have marketing, your proven strategies. And over here, we've got poor APIs and shoddy reporting that's in aggregate most of the time. There's lags and you have to work with what you got. But what we do is we spend so much time on the proven strategies up the top of the quadrant where we're working on observation on the small data set. And then down below, we've piped out pretty poor information that's incomplete that we have to make decisions on. right? Mm-hmm. And then we pick and choose the science, the sexy bits, and then we disregard the rest. What I'd like to see is people learn more about the science. That will give you better observations. That will then narrow down the bandwidth of your variables, and you're testing against your own data. Then you take the proven strategies, and then you test against those proven strategies for your product. Yeah. And then we all have to deal with the shitty pipey data that comes out of Amazon with APIs falling over, and I've got engineers up in the night fixing them, doing patches, so we don't lose fucking dashboards on our clients, you know?
So are you saying that to, as a seller, if particularly at the start, obviously this is when you're launching new products, it's probably the best chance you're going to get for this, is that don't judge everything based upon what you're seeing necessarily and what you've been told.
But that's hard to avoid, right? Because seeing is believing. Mm. And that's why I'm not here to gaslight anyone's reality. What I'm saying is use critical thinking. Understand there's something outside the Amazon community bubble that we don't know about. Embrace the unknown, look into it, and then make your own agency of decisions. You're your own person. Be critical.
Sort of just like an intelligent curiosity as to what's going on.
Have curiosity. That's what got you into the game. Okay? Mm-hmm. But then what happens is on the battlefield of Amazon, you're then going, oh, this is hard work. But what about this hack? What about this? And don't lose sight of these things. Mm-hmm. And this is why testing and stuff's important. And don't rely on just because something worked, just because there's a screen grab, that's a job well done. It's like a case study. It's someone putting their best foot forward. We all have case studies, right? You have a result and you share the result. Do you share the 99% or do you share the 1%? Everyone shares the 1%. Because we all know if you tested for a number of years, outside of the Amazon fear or inside of it, a lot of tests don't give you the results that you desire. And the results are in the number of tests that you take. So it's better to do 100 tests than it is 10, and then get 5 of those that do okay, because that could make a massive difference to your business or not. But you get better at testing as well. And if you get better at testing, you create the better hypotheses. And if you mix science, proven strategies, observations, and the Amazon data, then that gives you an extra layer of consideration of making more informed decisions for you and your business, you know?
I think that's something that all sellers can do quite easily, is say, even just knowing what I know now, this is what I want to test. This is my hypothesis of what I think the result will be. This is how we're tracking the results. Like, these are the data points. This is what we're looking at in terms of success or failure. Run the test, analyze against your hypothesis. If it did good, fantastic, congratulations, pat on the back, keep it. If not, why do you think that is? That forms new hypothesis. And then you keep going on around that process. And that's basically taking it back to like science at school. It's, you know, what's my hypothesis? We all learn this basically in school, I believe, maybe. And you all know, you know, when you have a graph and you have a line of best fit and you have an anomalies, these are sorts of things that a lot of people do understand, but they need to just get back into that when they're particularly operating on Amazon, who are, you know, data led essentially, this is what I think, this is the results. Okay. Yeah. What else do I think based upon this? Let's test that again. And the more you do that, I think you raise a really good point. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And actually the less emotional attachment you have to the hypothesis and the result.
Because in the very beginning, you've got an assumption. It doesn't matter what it is. Let's say you spent a lot of time redeveloping the main image. And it is superior in terms of quality, layout, design. You think you've got everything worked. You sat down with your team. You've got a better design team in. It pops. And then you run it and it doesn't. And you, well, I've used all the best practices. I've done all the call-outs. But you've done the templated version. The best practices and stuff. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a best practice, but if you use it as an example, let's say, you know, long landing pages with hypnotic copy, you know, white background, red text, and buttons to keep buying, and all the numbers and nines and sevens and stuff. You worked at Apple, right?
Yes.
If Apple launched a new product in their range or update an existing product on a long landing page like that, you'd look at that and go, fuck off, mate, this is a scam. The reason why you would say that is because that works, that style works for marketers to sell to other marketers, diet pills, people with ED, there's ways of that works for a certain crowd, but that won't work for Mercedes, Ferrari, and high street brands and stuff like that. So you've got to understand that what you're testing for is for your market, and people are good, right? They look at their hypothesis in terms of creating a custom avatar. You know, Sharon has spoken about it a lot on the show, and she's absolutely correct. But why don't you use one of the sites that are available? You're in Televi, your product opinion. I'm just giving you names. Use any of them. And then get your image deck tested against other images and get real feedback and then make the changes. Do you see what I mean? Because you're not above.
I agree, yeah. The product, like when we start, I wish I came up with things like product opinion myself. Because we, for years, we'd been taking screenshots, taking an image out, put another image in, send it to a group chat of, you know, your mates, to try and get like this data back. And I think the great thing with those tools particularly is you talk about customer objections, right, earlier.
Yeah.
That's where you can source those customer objections, you know, before people have bought the product. And, you know, before that, getting that information, you'd have to go to like your own user testing site, or you'd have to ask people, go to the street and physically ask people, go into Facebook groups. And to be honest, it's a pain in the ass. It's just a horrible process. Now, within the last couple of years, we've got much better tools where you can just get this information within about half an hour. So it kind of seems like, what excuse do you have to not
There's key areas of the excuse, right? People object to doing customer objections because it isn't the standard. The standard is use AI tools, scrape listings, look at post-purchase reviews and build on that, because we've culturalized the whole industry to operate this way. So when someone presents like the norm for conversion optimization outside of the Amazon industry, right? It's alien to them. So why would they do it? It's like, well, I can do a hack or I can spend time on it. So key problems is, one, they object to customer objections because it's boring, it's not sexy, I've found. Two, they think it's expensive when it's not. Okay, so I know people that would spend fortunes on sending TikTok traffic further up the conversion path to get a lower conversion rate whilst they haven't sorted out their objections on Amazon. And the reason they're doing TikTok, because they can't make it work on Amazon, but if they did the customer objections, they may find that they had a problem that they could solve and their conversion rate goes up, right? So first one is boring, it's not sexy. The second one is they think it's expensive when it's not. And the third one is summarizing the data. So what a lot of people do is they're looking for a unicorn. So I could sit there and go, here's the feedback from 10 video reviews, a small number, but number of pages. They go, yeah, that's shit. Yeah, but what? And I'm like, you missed it. And they said, what do you mean? So I sat down with them and we analyzed it together and we walked away with 8 customer objections. And then what we did is we designed images that met the customer objections. The fact is they were looking for a hit, right? They're looking for a hit single. When there's albums, there's 16 album tracks or 12 album tracks underneath, which are the nuances that make up the composite whole. Do you understand? So when you look at it, you've got to look at it in breaking it down into chunks and then look for the aspects that resonate with you and with the product and then break them down into sections, right? So it might be around durability. It might be opposing, like I use an example of GSM. You know, some people would use a graphic which says my GSM is bigger than your GSM, right? And not everyone knows what GSM. And then we did an image as an example why GSM matters. And then we had 3 products in there. Their product at 320, there was one at 200, and one at 180, I think. And you could see the materials getting thinner and thinner as you got down to the lowest one. So what we did, we got 2 objections met then. What is GSM, why it matters, and why are you paying a bit more for this product over all the others? Because quality matters and you know what you're getting because you can see the difference between the two. So that's one way of visualizing a customer objections. But I think what we do as a community, we say, get your brand in the lifestyle of the brand over to the customer. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but from all the testing I've done and other people have done, what we found is the customer is looking for a beautifully illustrated user manual, right, that meets the customer objections, and we're seeing the product in use. That's probably the easiest way I could summarize what they're
looking
for.
Call this, so we use this term for, I don't know, a few years now. And I think you've spoken somewhere about something similar before, when you can have the most beautifully designed image that is part of it.
Nothing.
Right? There's nothing.
It's beautiful, but it says nothing.
Exactly, yeah. So what we try and say, and I don't know exactly where this came from. Maybe we came up with, I don't know. It's quite a few years ago now. We said, well, we want functional design, as in the design is made to have a function and an output. And that output should be a feeling, a thought, an answer, or whatever it may be. So it doesn't actually matter. And I like what your images look like. It's just that they have to be functional in the output that they're giving. So like you said about the long sales letters, they wouldn't have started looking like that. It's just over time, people have, you know, done optimization. They realize, oh, red really works for this, or a green button really works here.
Yeah.
And it gets better and better.
Best practices and templates and stuff. And you go, and then what will happen, like what you said, someone say, with this template, it worked for me at X conversion rate. But what market, what product, is it a product, is it a service? What's the price point? Is it premium service? Do you understand? And that's why it's not saying that you shouldn't start somewhere. So let me give you like the anatomy of a landing page. You're not going to put the form at the bottom of the page. The chances are, because of directional eye scanning going back years for Google and the F motion, you're probably going to put the form on the right hand side of the page as they look from the top left down and they skitter through. So you would put the form somewhere. So you might call that a best practice. And then you may have an image on this side as a best practice to balance it out. And underneath, you might have a short title as best practice and a description, and it's all sitting above the fold. Get all that. But then you've got to think about the nuances, the market, what people are looking for. Do you need a form on your site? Does it need to be at the top? Are you trying to get leads? Or are you trying to sell a product? Where are we going next? Do you have an error code? Do you understand? So then you end up testing these things. So the only way to do that is get your customer avatar together, set a hypothesis, you test, you split test off of Amazon, right? They say use your third party website as an example, and then you are learning what the customer's like. And let's just say, like years ago, where this all really come from for me, I had a big failure. I lost £500,000, had to lay off a team, and we built something that no one wanted, and then I got destroyed on TechCrunch, right? And so we spent a year and a half in beta on this. So where I learned all this, one, it was from Peep Larger. Two, what was the startup, lean startup, Eric Ries? So I said to myself, I'm never going to build a business again without testing it. So I had a series of service businesses before I got into Amazon, into marketplaces. And so I launched a number of different businesses. One of them was a success that was in the six figures. I took it from zero into six figures. Was a French polishing company, and I owned Google on French Polisher and French Polisher London, because all of these people were still, back then, were using fax machines. So we killed it for a number of years, premium prices. So guys would send out polishers at £70 a day, and then that was the raw cost, and then they mark it up for their profit to say 135. And if I say I'm going to send one of my guys, he's 350. You go, well, look, I can pay X amount for that because it's a volume game. And I go, well, I can put my guy on, give him 50 doors to touch in, right? Not full strip and polish, touch in, and give your guys 50 doors. They'll whip through it because of the skill set. But then I had to understand that most of these polishing companies are working for the big companies where they borrow your company, put them on site, and then they're just retouching stuff. So I had to learn building that website can't be looking like all the other sites. I have to tailor it. So if you want your boardroom table done, if you wanted to have your handrails done, if you have a bit of money and you're willing to spend on it, or you've got something in the family, you would pay for quality. So the website had to align with that. Because if I was putting a dozen guys, do you understand? So I did a number of those, and the quickest way I found out is you build your hypothesis, which is the landing page. You put, because back then you could still get phone numbers. I had Call Metrics, a software that can generate a load of numbers for you, and then it pipe it through to your mobile. So I'd launch one, build a web, like the landing page, launch it on Google, run the ads, and it was call based. And from the calls, I could ascertain whether this is a business or not, the type of clients it was, and then update as I go. And if it didn't work, it doesn't matter, I'd dump it. So I dumped a number of them. Like, so I had two that did well. It was the French polishing company and resin flooring. So that's for your driveways, your offices, and there's different type of resin, like this solid resin that go. But a lot of people had block paving, so you had that battle to go against as well. They were the two most successful, but we had like compressors. We had one which was for a mastic people, you know, like to go around and do all the mastic in the bathrooms. And there was a few others. So I tested them, they all failed. And this is why I say testing is important, because you don't want to burn through half a million like I did, launch the bloated thing that no one wanted, get destroyed on TechCrunch. So you learn heavy from these things. And that's where all my testing really come from.
That's a hard lesson to learn, but it's certainly an important one. The people listening should be like, well, maybe I should spend a few hundred dollars on a bit of testing, because those insights could lead to my business literally being successful, or me deciding to go down a different route with what we're actually doing. Like you mentioned, like best practices. So this is something that, like, I have a best practice, right? It's not always true, but it will be, it takes about a second for someone to read three words on a page. So I know that if I've got 20 words on an Amazon image, likelihood that everyone's going to scroll through them between 1 and 3 seconds, they're not going to read that, right? However, that doesn't mean that that's the rule. There are exceptions to that. Like if there was
You gave me a nuance there, right? When I talk best practices, they're going to say, optimize your title, put your keywords in there, optimize your bullets, get your benefit. And, you know, it's the standard stuff that's trotting out. What you're doing is more scientific. You've come up with a thing, well, no one is going to read more than three words a second. So there's a nuance to you must optimize your title. So the best practice is the wider part. The nuance is, what have you developed underneath that works for your customer or your application of doing this? So effectively, that is in the best practice.
So you want to then find... But the nuances for your company.
Yeah.
For your,
so what you would do is let's say you're launching a page, right? You will go on to, say it's WordPress. You'll pick a theme that you like. And then what do? You customize that theme to fit your business, your market, and everything else. So what I'm saying is don't rely on the best practice end of and expect the results of that best practice. You take those and then it works out within the nuances and then you're making the changes. You have to start somewhere, and you need a theme, you need a template, right? You may even, I've seen it before, take other people's copy. You're not using it, you know, index the page, and then they rewrite this page that's not the same, but they're using it as guidance with completely different words.
Well, you're from a music background, right? So this is really common to take influence, you know, from, you know, no music is created, it's all... It's taken influence.
It's all been done before, yeah.
It's been done before. And I would say the same thing happens with business with Amazon. It's very little or very seldom does someone create something new. It's I'm taking influence from here, I take it from here, I take it from here, I take it from here. And that forms my new thing.
And I agree that, because what I was known for in the music industry, I used to have a show on Kiss. There was a scene, very short-lived, between about 98 and 2002, it was popping. It was called New School Breaks. I put out an album called New School Breaks, mixed by Rennie Pilgrim with a guy called Rennie Pilgrim. You won't know any of these names. But we create a scene with a few other people that you could put in a telephone box. But that allowed me to travel the world as the DJ and the producer and have a show on Kiss and everything else. And it goes back to your point. Our influences, like some of the guys would be influenced from drum and bass, right? And then some of them, like me, was Detroit Techno, Juan Atkins, Derek May, people that you may never heard of, right? You've heard songs like Strings of Life, I'm a lot older than you, but all my influences was the breakbeat I did was more melodic. Think of liquid drum and bass. So LTJ Bookham and people like that, all the strings and stuff like that. Whereas someone had more like the gnarly bass line. They're all influences. So what happens is new things come from a crossroad of matching other things. And it normally comes out of the desperation of being stuck in something else. So we were making records. Some might be in the underscene of drum and bass, had enough and made some breakbeat records and then blew up, which they did. There was a few people. And or you're into house or techno and you're not going anywhere with it. And then you develop a breakbeat strand of the similar stuff that you do. So everything influences everything. There's a crossroad. When you listen to a podcast or you go to an event or a mastermind, you're influenced by that. We have an, you know, like an echo chamber. And so honeymoon period, someone says it, then someone else says it. If you look at LinkedIn and the comment sections, it just, a lot of the comments are reiterating the main post for the sake of having a comment. So they're influenced to leave a comment about what they've been influenced by above. So me and you are susceptible, and everyone else, to all the influences around you, but it depends what we consume and what we allow to consume.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, you know, you say it's like an echo chamber, and you're your own echo chamber as well, right? So I might not know the things that I probably might need to know, but I can tell myself that I do know them, or I'm going to use this strategy or this technique or whatever, and I talk myself into it, or I talk myself out of it. That's why I feel it's important to get a variety of opinions or data or whatever, even if I disagree, even if I don't understand it, or I do like it and I think it's the best thing ever. The point is that you can't learn, you can't grow. If you were a musician that never listened to music, right? You wouldn't make music. You wouldn't do anything because you would not have influence.
Do you know where artists get their inspiration from?
Go on.
They get their inspiration by listening to music that they're not making.
Yes.
So you get what's called a writer's block. Writers get it for writing books, whether it could be poetry, it could be writing novels, doesn't matter. And as a musician, engineer, programmer, you know, record producer, however you want to place it, that is a creative hub, right? And then what happens is at the beginning of the session, let's say you're working with someone new, you'd pull out your vinyl back then and it'd be, you know, it'd be Spotify or whatever now, and then you'd play records. And you go, I really like that. And the way that they improvised here, it depends if that's jazz. If it's dance track, I go, really love that low pass filter on the way that it comes back in as the drums come back in with that bass. And if we put a little bit of an LFO like that, it's not, and they're all influences. And then that's the creative spark. And then you go for a dry spell. So you produce a load of stuff and then you can't hit a, what was it? What was the saying that we used to use? You can't hit a barn door with a banjo. And then you'd be out the studio for a week and then you're thinking, shit, I've lost me touch, I lost my creative spirit. And then a record will come on the radio and it will blow your mind and suddenly everything comes back and then you're back in the game. So it, we what we do on Amazon World is a creative process, and we'll go through waves of being highly creative and under creative.
Yes.
Do you understand? Yeah. And they are influences from everywhere that we get, but we may not always know it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think there's a kind of catch 22 here as well. Whenever I listen to podcasts or I watch a webinar or go to an event or anything like that, always immediately after, there is some sort of motivation to do something, right?
Yeah.
However, it doesn't mean I always do something, and this is where there can be the catch of you know, just seeking knowledge and seeking information, but then not doing anything about it. And sometimes, I get doing nothing is the right thing to do. But I a lot of sellers, I think, and this is just what I think, is that they are big consumers and sometimes little doers. And I think that's a really, it's an easy trap
to
fall into.
Well, I would be more fair on to say that they're little doers in certain areas. They consume it, but then overwhelmed with the workload that they do. So it goes on the list of things I'd like to do, but then Amazon should tug down the listing. So to be a bit more fairer, I think they've got so much capacity. But at least it gives them the inspiration to keep going on a tough day when they hear something. You know, like you hear a record, you hear a tip. Wow, I'll try that tomorrow. Suddenly it all comes back, right? And you're back in the game because you go up and down on a bit of a roller coaster in any area of any area of business.
So would you say when we kind of come back to surviving Amazon, right?
Yeah.
We've talked about a lot today and we've gone through data and we've gone through essentially a lot of mindset stuff. When we think about what allows someone not to survive, right? Is there any common denominators you find?
Okay, let's go. I did a show a few years ago. We had Ellis on there. We had Evelyn Demerov and a few other people. We called it the luck of the Amazon seller because there's so many different variables. So let me give an example. Let's say you've killed it in one category, all right? And then you launch a new brand. You apply everything you did to that and it just didn't work. It doesn't matter what you did. You got the money, they got the resources, you used all the same methodologies, the same SOPs, everything. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work. Some things are just out of your control. A hack, best practice. And so I think what we have to allow for is from 15 to now, it's become more expensive and more complex and a bigger moat. But no one's got 100% strike rate. Mm-hmm. And I think what we've got to be careful of is people projecting that there is and no one has. The strike rates have gone down. And all I say is it goes back to, because I could sit here and talk about, you know, like with the science papers, people go, yeah, why is he bothered with all these science papers? Fucking, what's he going to do with them? Do you know what I've done with them? 4 years of accumulation of knowledge has allowed me to build tools personally for my uses and for my clients that don't exist because of having that knowledge. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. So the benefits isn't always short term. The benefits is long term. And like you said earlier on, there's inspiration and there's discipline. I knew there was something in the science, so I went all in on that. Whereas you could speak to other people and they do absolutely everything on Amazon, across Amazon Post, every ad type, but everything else. Whereas what I do personally is I've only got so much time and attention. I'm going to pick a few things and go deep. Mm-hmm. And that's what I say to sellers as well. You've got to dial out the noise because your most important assets is your time and attention. It's not money. Money's a tool. Let me explain. Your time and attention, you have to divide it up. You could be on your third marriage, okay, and your children despise you, but you've got a lot of money. Why? Because you put all your time and attention in that. So you've got to work out where do you put your time and attention, because it requires time and attention to make money. So when you haven't got the bandwidth, you've got to be boundaries with yourself and then pick, I'm going, that's it. These are the 2 to 3 things that are manageable that you can develop. And yep. I think if you can do that, like there's nothing more important than product. I don't care what anyone says, mm-hmm. right? The product first, second to that is to find your customer objections and then find a way to meet them. If you do that, your conversion rate will go up. Your PPC will work better. Your cost per clicks will be better. Your conversion rate, everything impacts it. If you understand you've got a good product and you met the objections, all the rest is just works on top. So I go back to focus on the basics. Sorry, go on.
No, sorry to cut you off there. I mean, it sounds kind of lame when you say it, right? It's like, you know, every house is built on foundations. And it's like, it's something we've heard so many times. If you don't get the foundations right, there's a reason why those sayings exist, right? Because
it's boring. There's no dopamine rush. Yeah, it's not sexy. Exactly. It's not a secret. You don't know that someone else is. You're not in the important club with everyone else on that expensive, this, that, and that. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. But the reality,
if we get down to it,
it's just, do you have the foundations, the absolute basics? Have you done those? Because then everything becomes easier. And I talk about this with PPC. PPC isn't right or wrong, right? No, like if you have a good product and you have good foundations, it's very hard to run bad PPC. It's extremely hard to run it because it just works, or it's, you know, it's putting fuel onto the fire.
This is why, you're right. Let me break in there. Basically, PPC is a visible amplification machine, right? Mm-hmm. And what it does, if you depends on now what you're utilizing it for, right? You want it at top of search, okay? Mm-hmm. So it sits at top of search, you're bidding, et cetera. I'm dialing out. I'm not getting into the weeds. I'm dialing back. If you dial back and you go, okay, run PPC, I'm visible now, I'm top of search. And people go, won't buy, 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 will buy. Won't buy, won't buy, won't buy. Then someone comes to you and go, have you got a magical PPC campaign? Because a lot of people, well, you're at top of search. Let's go back to the product.
Yep.
Do you understand? But you don't want to say that in a way, it's meant to help not to be insulting in any way because you get attached to it. If you're providing a service and you're not getting the results that they desire, but they've got the visibility, you've got to take it back and go, what do we need to look at? So some will say, it's not the product, I need a magical PPC campaign. Mm-hmm. So this is why I built this tool in-house, this is only for in-house, is to give them an idea of how they could possibly perform on these search terms, be spending money. Then they're compared in within those organically ranked. And then they can see the big differentiation between their product and theirs and what is possible to fix. Because you show them, you're not telling them. And I run that at my own cost. So I won't say how much it is, but if I run to 100 people, I can show that to a client and save them a lot of money on a launch. And but if I say to them, look, I think you need to do this, this, then look, my product, I know my product. And it's true. The customer will know their product better than any agency, third party and everything else, because they built it with their, you know, sweat, blood and tears. But I think you have to show people. So instead of me saying anything, go, give me a few hours, send a report. Shit, Dan, look, yeah, look, I'll come in temp. Suddenly it's like, oh yeah, we can change this. I don't have to say anything. I show them. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think the hard thing is that sometimes you want to show people that, or you want people to just do that themselves, right? So that they can see, well, this is what is happening, because the exact same thing is happening on Amazon. It's they just don't see it in the same way that they would see it.
That's why the science has been hard, because seeing is believing. You've got your observations, you've got your proven strategies, and you've got your reporting. Anything beyond that is like, well, I have to question it. And so you should. So always going to be questioned. But I would say that's why you add the fourth layer to it. And then you combine the science with your observations to make better observations, to run better tests. Do you understand? And your proven strategies. I think we've been indoctrinated a certain way. Everyone's played their role in it. That's not shade. But I think if we get back to the critical thinking again, I don't want to do like say it in mindset ways. Like, is it that difficult to say to someone, go and do a test? I'll give another example. I still test everything now. Like, we just finished building our own ticketing platform for seller sessions. One, it says if I do, which I don't always do, pass on the booking fee because our tickets are low priced in comparison to others, or I eat the fee. And got enough of spending thousands in fees on Eventbrite, so we built our own ticketing platform. Now, me and Alex spent 3 days on the customer journey, 3 weeks on three pages, which is the customer journey through the checkout. And we thought we'd nailed it. And then we pulled the team in to do feedback. And I said, I'm going to run it on product opinion as a first layer test, right? And I'm going to carry on testing it. So we run it on there. I got 10 video feedbacks. 10. And then I gave Alex 40 micro changes from them 10 videos. And then what I'm going to do is retest that and test that again until it's refined. Do you understand? So if I can go on product, it doesn't matter where you go. If I can get product video feedback of the customer journey and they're speaking openly about their thoughts and I document everything and that gives me 40 changes off 10 videos. Now, you might only find five. I've been doing this since 2008. I see the nuances because I've spent a lot of time going deep on learning it. That bit isn't hard. You've got a product, it's not working. Even from 10 videos, you'll get insights that no one else is going to tell you.
Even if you get one, I mean, it's better than not doing it, right?
I think what people are looking for is the one. It's the hack. It's the hit. It's the unicorn. It's pissing rainbows. Once we get rid of that mindset, it's the composite hull. You get 10 micro changes built to composite hull. Look for those because you very rarely get the thunderbolt. You iterate when you're doing optimization.
Well, yeah, so I had a really good example of this, the product that we're doing very shortly. And it was, you know, we're doing the video responses and people were saying, oh, I kind of like this one with the little lightning bolt and but maybe this one with the price. And I heard a few people say lightning bolt, right? So it's not the golden goose or anything like that. But I thought, I hate that as a design aspect with the lightning bolt coming out. I fucking hate it. I think it looks awful. But that at that point, I decided, right, my ego needs to drop. Let's just put it in. But how do we make it different? Rather than blue, let's make it blue and orange, right? And then let's test it again. Does our lightning bolt now stand out more than other people's lightning bolts? And the answer is it did. But the point is if we hadn't have gone through those videos thoroughly, right? Because it wasn't mentioned in all of them. It was only like three or so.
And one thing, just big shout out to the boys at Product Opinion for the way they break down everything, so you assume you don't have to write up notes, right? Mm. And it's very good, the cement, sentimental analysis that they do. Very, very good. But make sure you watch the video and make your own notes and then put that against the analysis, because there's nuances that you can add on there. Because people go, fuck it, I ain't going to write it out. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
put it on 1.5 speed, write little bullets as you're going through, and then you look at the analysis, and then you cross-reference those, and then you compile whether they're fixes like we did for the checkout. We end up, I say iterative, there was one big change. What we did, I'll give you an example. We thought we were clever by putting in the long, it is a long landing page, but it's not all like the creepy text. It's all the information on the event, right? And we explain what the event's about, the workshops that we have on, so everything's there, the speakers, So it ends up being quite long, not huge, but it's not just reams of text, no images, white background. It's designed, right? But what we did is we put the ticket section where you can add to cart in the page. And then we clicked out to the standardized ticketing where you go through the process. You know, like when you look on Stripe, white background, plain and everything else. So you add to cart, then when you go to the cart, it then goes to the white background and it's very plain. The reason why they remove all very plain, it looks shit, is to remove every distraction. Whereas we add highlighting the text, you know, discount on this, blah, blah, blah. And the way that we are able to say, if you add this to cart, we can say, we can have a dinner and upgrade it. But it's done in such a way, it's a bit more friendly to the end user, right? Instead of using banners and stuff. We did that in page. And a lot of people complained about that because what we had was, we had the landing page that told you about the event, and we didn't separate that part of the ticketing from the buying cycle. And that's where we fucked up. So what we end up doing is that we had the buy buttons on the page that takes us to the white background for the ticketing. And then on that page, we're able underneath is to put the FAQs about the conference once you purchased the ticket, which is different from the landing page of the sales cycle of buying, why you would buy the ticket, click the ticket, and when you buy it, what are the nuances you need to understand, what your questions, refund, do you understand? And so we've separated it there, and that's what I'm going to
So retake. Almost you're saying, how do I get someone to this next step? They don't necessarily need to understand these particular things. They're not important right now. But on this next step, that is going to be the thing that prevents someone from buying, right? Or having a bit of confusion. So let's tell them that information there. And almost attending to the fact that people are, they want to see things in a certain way, that, hey, if it's on the same page, maybe this doesn't feel right, because normally I'm taken to a white page.
And it was so small, is that, let's say that you're still being distracted by above and below. That part, that ticketing part, was in the wrong part of the journey. It needed to be not in the marketing and the sales journey. It had to be in the buying, completing purchase journey. It was wrong. And so what we could have done, let me run a analogy. I could be, I'm a seller, I know my market, I'm successful on Amazon. He's like me saying, I've done conversion rate optimization since 2008. I know what I'm doing. Me and Alex are good at what we do. We spent 3 weeks on it, therefore it's good enough. And it worked. And then we done one, that major change, but there was 39 micro changes we missed. The team missed. And I'm going to test it again. Do you understand? So I had to go, we could have an ego. We'd say, oh yeah, it's the fucking bollocks. Don't worry, they're going to buy it, you know? And then you find out, no, this is terrible. This is wrong. And it takes a bit and you go, damn, they're right. Let's make those changes. But one thing I would say about testing, there's needle moving testing. And then there's testing the fourth bullet point and letting that run in Amazon experiments for 3 months and looking for a yield. Do you understand? So test what matters. And so your checkout page is the most important on your e-commerce website. So we went there first. We built the checkout and then we filled it with the information. So when you do tests, test for the right things. Don't do vanity testing. Test for move the needle.
So if we know that most of our sales are made really from the images, hey, let's make sure that we can knock out those images first of all. And does the fourth bullet point matter right now? No one's even getting to it.
Oh, it matters, but you have priorities, don't you?
Exactly.
What are you going to move the needle with? The fourth bullet, that maybe people don't read or what everyone sees. You look on mobile, most of mobile, well, I say most, a lot of mobile, when you're scrolling, what's it dominated by? The image.
Well, it's going to be your images, yeah. What's especially behind especially the images? If you've got your Zoom, you know, you're like, you know, you wear glasses and your phone's like that.
And what's behind that image that a lot of people don't understand or not working on is their image attributes. Mm. What does Rufus read? He's reading various information. But let's imagine that your main image is the most important thing. Are you training your labels, right? This is extreme. Are you training the labels on that image, okay, in AWS for Amazon recognition to make sure that you do have the right confidence score for the right objects in the image, or do you need to retrain them? You can go to huge levels for this stuff. Or are you going to put some call outs to a certain degree on the image? The latest trend is whack it in Canva, stick a bit of fruit behind it and put a swing tag on. Yeah. That isn't going to work for everything. What about your drop shadows? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so there's so many things that, that you can do. It goes back to best practices and go back to your nuances. But it's easy to put a bit of fruit on it in Canva if you go, oh, look, I'm selling and the ingredient is raspberry. And that's good. I want you to do
it. But if it works, this is the thing. If it works.
Test if it works.
Who,
it might not
work. Who cares, right? You know, add on a raspberry if you really want to. And if, you know, it's fine. If your swing tag works, stick it on there. If it doesn't work, then obviously don't have
it
there.
Well, if you remember.
Thinking, oh, it should work.
An experiment, like what I tried to do and I didn't fully pull it off. You want to get your keyword in the image. We've seen this with the kitchen brand with the Hall of Famer image, you know, with the milk whisk. And that's really where a lot of it come from, getting your keyword on the packaging. Well, what if you haven't got packaging? So one of the things that we were doing, it didn't work as well. It was a translucent food bag. And we messed around trying to emboss the keyword. Like it's a logo. So what we tried to do, basically, where did that come from? Influence. We ain't got a swing tag and we haven't got a box. What are we going to do? What if we embossed it on the product, but then reduce the size, and then we run it through recognition, and then we realized it got to a certain size and then it didn't get picked up in AWS's recognition. So how do we get around that? We'll change the font. As soon as we changed the font, the characteristics in the object, or in the text, sorry, not the object, came back, and then we're able to add that in there, and it's kind of nuanced, and you probably ain't going to get a review that says, hey, where is my embossed keyword?
Oh, yeah. They're not going to.
Do you understand? So when you're testing, try different things. If someone's doing a swing tag, think of other inventive ways. You might not have a swing tag or a packaging. Can you emboss? One of the things we tried to do with Cara's thing, and it didn't work out, is a test on the show is the UV plus 50. What about a sticker? You know, when you get a product and quite often you're peeling back the stickers. If you look at, you worked at Apple, open the box up, you pull back the films, the stickers, the warnings and stuff like that. What about translucent stickers that says 50? You know, it's testing those ideas as well, beyond the swing tag, beyond the packaging, beyond the box, beyond the embossed. Think about what you can try and test for.
I think that's something that people can, that's an actionable piece of advice that people can take away and do something about it today. You know, you can test these things and you can look at images and go, well, how can we do this? How can we get this keyword in there? If we're doing it for recognition and for the algorithm, cool. But if we're doing it for the customer, then what can we use instead? Like, we've seen big differences on just moving a keyword on a box from there to there, like, or making it 25% bigger. It sometimes makes a difference. And we don't know exactly why, it just did. So I think that's something that people can literally take away today. Are there a couple more, just as we round this up, a couple more like actionable things that people can go, right now, I want to improve my sales, I want to do better, what can I actually go and do?
It's the nuances. One of them, look at your back-end attributes, and then look for Wana's bot. Go to sellersessions.com, look at the Cosmo article. There's instructions how to use the bot. That bot is basically full of the whole Amazon's catalog, flat files, and a number of other things which we won't share that's in there, which allows you to take your image. Like, let me give an example. Two things that you can do if we're focusing on advice for images. Take your main image, and then when you go to add a listing to Amazon, you've got like the, you know, where it can generate an AI title and stuff. Just throw your image at it and see what title it gives you and the subcategory. Then it's, you know, it's reading your image. Mm-hmm. You go into recognition. What does it say on the image? Because when people put loads of accessories in the image, the OCR gets confused. So the objects, you know, you could be selling a pencil case and it comes up as a first aid kit, as an example. So we're talking image attributes, right? What does Rufus read? It reads everything, including back-end attributes, image attributes. It's in the nuances. If you go and use Wana's bot, right, we can add it to the show notes or whatever. Mm-hmm. It will generate all of the uses, the optional ones for your product. And we have to, or she has to recycle all that every 3 to 6 months to cater for it, to stay on top of it. But basically, you could go through, let's say that you got 10, 15, 20 listings with missing attributes. Mm-hmm. It's a 15, 20 minute, 30, an hour's job. Complete all the attributes. Because that's okay. The missing puzzle, right, is the attributes.
Amazon what it needs.
Give them what it's need. And because everyone's quick to fill out the keyword field, but mm-hmm. no one's quick to fill out the 5 different variants on the uses that you can do and come up with creative things. This is why we're trying to build tools for the boring shit that no one wants to do, who don't think it's important when it's really fucking important. This is why when the patent says initial prior prediction is taken from similar products that are performing well and their attributes. So everyone's on reverse acing, right? Imagine if you had a tool that does a reverse attribute.
Yeah.
On all of it in terms of the optionals and, right? That information there is gold as well. So then you have to interpret that. This is why we've got that bot. And then there's a bot that we built. It's not for you to use completely in your listing. The way I see things now with listings is you've got your lexical match. So your beard oil is a lexical match. Then you've got your beard conditioner, your semantic. And then, so what I've done is I've built a little bot that will give us the variation. So I can prompt it and say, can you give me the variations on this product? Well, I start with giving it the image. What does it see? And it tells me what it sees. And then I say, can you give me 10 variations of lexical, semantic, and BERT matching? Then it gives me a list of those. Why can I use those? Well, there might be ideas that I can use for back-end attributes on the client's listing, which is alternative phrasing and words, in other words. And what else can you do that? You can wash that against your brand analytics reports to see if it's got, if there's any search frequency rank on it. Because what you'll find is in the US, and it's less in the UK, let's say you've got a long list of keywords, we use the third party tool, and you wash that against brand analytics, and the ones that are missing, generally meaning, it's not exclusive, if that search term is not in the brand analytics report, it's more than likely you've got 10 or less searches per day. So there's no point in using it for, you know, for a limited amount of searches for the conversion and yield that you would get. And a lot of people make mistakes when they cross their products across the pond, whether it's UK to US. So if you're in the US, you've got an enrichment of deep niches with lots of keywords. You go to UK, that list could cut in half or in a quarter. So make sure you do research based on each marketplace. So do all your attributes, use Wana's bot for that. What else is there? When you're using recognition, when you're using comprehend, everyone's after a high score for the sentiment. You've got to make sure that your entities and types are right. Yeah, organization, what else is there? Organization, quantities. So what you need to do is you analyze, you know, say you don't put your brand name in at the front of the title, as an example, then you don't have an organization tag if it's not mentioned in the listing and it's a priority. So what you can do is you can work out, well, that's the wrong tag. You might have a commercial tag on the misappropriation of the style of the product or the version of that variation. So you want to make edits and then you get them tags. So the idea is you want to make sure you get those tags as well. This is the micro optimization from the science that no one sees. And a lot of people are now moving towards this. So we need better tools to do that, and AI is allowing us to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can first of all access those at sellersessions.com.
Yeah, if you go to the A9 section, and I'll give them to the show notes, because there's a few tools that we have that we'll give out to people. They just make our job a lot easier. And as I said, we design stuff going down that route of the science, being on it for 4 years. You go, why is he fucking wasting his time? Now I've got deep knowledge domain in looking for what I want and need. I'm now at a stage where I'm putting more of the jigsaw together. And what comes from that, if you read that 10,500 words and go through, there's a lot of stuff in there that's actionable. But what I'm trying to do is give people a foundation. Rather than give them hacks and do it this way, I'm saying do it, use this as your foundation and then test on top. Because everyone can tell you the one-off proven strategies. But going back earlier on is what creative are you come up with? Are you going to use a swing tag on everything? Are you going to use a box on everything? Or are you going to come up with my version or try and experiment? Can we emboss it in this translucent bag to make it look natural by still getting the keyword in there? That's what I want you to do. I want you to have an edge by not copying everyone else, but coming with your own innovations. Like you'd innovate on the product. You do all that research. Why? To build a better mousetrap. So you Frankenstein a new mousetrap based on everyone's product. Why wouldn't you test the same? Why wouldn't you try different things outside of the swing tag? Start the swing tag, start the box, start the fruit on you, and then build on there.
So to kind of sum this up, what I'm really getting from your thought processes here is understand the foundation, first of all, from the science perspective of just read it, right? At the very least, just read it and understand it. And then critically think about how that can be implemented for you personally and for your customers, not how, you know, Joe Bloggs did it and X, you know, tip that you saw online. It's what do you think about this information about, you know, your customers?
Let's not skip the fact that you should, if someone's got a proven strategy, test it. Mm-hmm. But don't expect that you're going to get the 80% uplift in conversion. Test, use it and go, that's a good idea. I'll use that to test. And then what you do, you make tweaks. And you go, well, that didn't kind of work for me, but now I've got an idea for another test off of that. And that's where your wins come. That's how you land your wins.
Exactly. Just like that example I gave you earlier of this image, the second image, it worked on two ASINs, did absolutely nothing on other ones. And it's just, hey, this worked, let's try it again. It worked, let's try it again.
Do you know the best place to start with this? Another example, right? Take your worst performing products. Everyone has them. There's an 80-20 rule, generally speaking, right? Very few people knock it out in the park with every product. So you got your also rent. What you could do, like we did it, we had a client, or still got a client that's got a product just doing 2 units a day. We got that up to 10 units a day, purely, right, purely by using Comprehend and just ramping the sentiment score. Fucked off keywords and everything else, and it went to 10 sales a day. Tried it on something else, didn't work.
Yeah.
But at least that's doing from 2 to 10 units on a dead product that I was going to get rid of.
Yeah.
That's ticking over. But it won't work for everything. That's why you've got to be, one, come up with a test, understanding how testing works, and then come up with your own formulas and hypotheses to test. The more you do, the better you get, the more creative you get with it.
Amazing.
And that's where the science comes in as well.
That I think that is that's a good statement to end up on.
Okay.
So I'm going to say thank you, Danny. I really appreciate you helping us survive Amazon through
science. Everyone's out there trying to do their bit.
But look, guys, if you've liked this episode and you found it helpful, please do share it with other sellers. Subscribe, comment, and like if you're watching it on YouTube and whatnot, so we can help other sellers survive on Amazon. Thanks again, Danny. I really, really appreciate your time. And I hope people action, you know, and pick up what you've been putting down today.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. Thank you for your time and attention. And obviously, reach out to me if you need anything.
Amazing.